Hi, welcome to New Zealand Vegan Podcast. This is episode 32, and I'm very, very pleased to welcome back to the show Professor Gary L. Francione. Professor Francione is a distinguished professor of law and a Nicholas Dippy Katzenberg Scholar of Law and Philosophy at Rutgers University School of Law in Newark, New Jersey. He has authored several books, including Vivisection and Dissection in the Classroom, A Guide to Conscientious Objection, Animals, Property, and the Law, Rain Without Thunder, The Ideology of the Animal Rights Movement, Introduction to Animal Rights, Your Child or the Dog, Animals as Persons, Essays on the Abolition of Animal Exploitation. And there is a new book coming out, which we discussed briefly at the end of the interview. So I really hope that you enjoy the interview with Professor Francione. Thanks for listening. Okay, so I'd like to welcome to the show today Gary Francione. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. It's very, very nice to be back with you. I'm impressed by the work that you're doing, and I'm happy to be part of it.
Well, thank you very much, and I must say, welcome to Twitter.
Well, you know, Elizabeth, not only have I opened a Facebook account. Again, these are things that I had to be dragged into by by various people because I'm not a technical sort of person. Indeed, you know, my view has been, well, you know, you write books, you write articles, you get the ideas out, you go, you give lectures, you talk with people, and that's how you do it. But I understand that in the 21st century, there are these fora available, and that a lot of young people like to participate in them, in these what are called social networking-ish situations, which I find somewhat peculiar, but you know, look, I mean, I can change with the times. And so I'm on Twitter. I haven't yet started with Facebook because I'm still preoccupied with finishing my book. But you know, it's interesting, Elizabeth. I saw an essay that was referred to on Twitter a couple of days ago, and it was on a blog that is run by an abolitionist advocate in Canada. The name of the blog is or the website is My Face Is on Fire, and so it was referred to on Twitter. And is it Twitter or Tweeter? What is it?
Twitter.
What is the Twitter?
Twitter,
okay.
And then when you leave a message, you're tweeting. It's a tweet.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for that. You see, you learn something new.
I just learned it myself.
You learn something new every day. So I read the essay written by this person, and it was an extremely well-written, professional analysis and critique of the welfare reform positions that are advocated by the Humane Society of the United States and particularly focusing on the fact that welfare reform and these campaigns for welfare reforms create sort of a strange symbiosis between the welfarists and industry, and so they end up sort of you end up having animal welfare people saying, look, you know, we're really trying to work with industry, we're trying to help industry, which is true, they are. And her point was that's a problem, that raises moral issues. It also raises issues of practical strategy as to whether that's a good thing to do. And these are issues, of course, with which I agree with the writer of that essay wholeheartedly. I've been saying these sorts of things for a long time now, and so I agree with her. And so I read this essay. I thought this is a very, very good essay. And then I noticed that there were some comments that had immediately followed that were. I had to go back and reread her essay because I didn't think that they were referring to the same essay, because they were accusing her of vilification and you know, and attacking and expressions of wrath and stuff. And I went back and I said, all she's done is express disagreement. And so I then weighed in, and then other people started weighing in, and now there are almost about, I guess, well, they're probably by now 100 comments to this to her essay, and I think it's really worth people to go and read the exchange, because I think first of all you can learn a lot about the debate between the abolitionist and the welfarist position, but secondly you can see a very, very interesting phenomenon that comes up again and again and again. It's been coming up for the now going into 3 decades I've been doing this, and that is the phenomenon of any sort of criticism of the welfarist position is immediately characterized in very pejorative ways as bashing or vilification, or, you know, if you don't approve of welfare reform, you don't really care about the animals, and a lot of it's just very, very interesting. Or so and so is a great welfarist and spends a lot of his time doing this work, and therefore your attack of him is horrible and scurrilous and whatnot, and it's very interesting to me, you know, as a sort of a matter of just sociological phenomena, as a sociological phenomena, to sort of, there's no discussion, there's no debate, there's no, no one's really trying to engage, no one on the welfare side is really trying to engage this issue substantively. What they're trying to do is to sort of characterize any criticism as the refusal to accept that we need to help animals who are suffering now, and as an attack on anybody who is promoting welfare reform. And what's interesting is they've got it wrong. The debate is not about attacking welfarists, at least not from my perspective and not from the perspective of the people that I am aware of who are working in this area. And that is, no one's making a judgment. I'm certainly not making a judgment about the personal integrity or of the sincerity or whatever of the people who are involved in welfare reform. I know many of them personally. I'm not making any moral judgments about them. I like some of these people, actually. But that's not the point. The point is that the whole structure is corrupt, in that these welfare groups, in order to survive, basically are forced into becoming advisors to the animal agricultural industry, in which they're basically, you know, working with animal agriculture and trying to make animal agriculture economically beneficial for producers of animal products. And this activity does not have any positive benefit for animals. That is, it's not that there are wonderful things happening and there are significant welfare benefits that are being provided for animals as a result of these welfare reforms. I would still have a philosophical, theoretical problem with supporting these reforms, even if they did, you know, even if they were providing, remarkable improvements in animal welfare. But Elizabeth, the reality is they're not. These are, you know, they're not doing that at all. They're cage-free eggs. First of all, let's talk about the gestation crate and the veal crate. These are big issues with the animal welfare people. The gestation crate and the veal crate are on their way out anyway. They are economically inefficient ways of raising animals. The agricultural economists have pointed out quite clearly that alternatives to the gestation crate, like electronic sow feeding, for example, increases productivity and is beneficial for producers in all sorts of ways. The veal crate, there are many problems with the veal crate, but one of the problems from the standpoint of producers is that veal crates, because they create such stress with the animals, the same is true of gestation crates, but because these intensive methods create such stress on animals, they create all sorts of veterinary problems. And to the extent that money has to be spent on animals for veterinary care in order to get them to slaughter, that's an opportunity cost that ends up having to be factored into production cost. And both gestation crates and electronic sow feeding are – clearly economically inefficient. If you were starting a veal operation today, if you were starting a pig raising operation today, you would be irrational to use these two methods of confinement. If you were starting from scratch and you didn't have to worry about capital costs, about your initial capital costs, you would be crazy. You know, same thing with controlled atmosphere killing for chickens. This is another big campaign that people have in the United States right now. They're trying to get these fast food outlets to go with controlled atmosphere killing or controlled atmosphere stunning rather than electric stunning of chickens. Now, if you were starting a chicken operation today, you would be irrational not to go with controlled atmosphere killing because economically it's much better in all sorts of ways for producers than is the electrical stunning method. So what I'm saying is these, and what many of us are saying, is that these welfare reforms are really providing, I mean, you know, these are the things that are being attacked are economically inefficient. They're on their way out anyway. And when they change, what we're going to have is a new system which will be economically beneficial for the producers, may provide minuscule, and I say may provide minuscule benefits, welfare benefits for the animals. But the idea that these welfare reforms are minimizing, that's a word that is used, that they're minimizing animal suffering, or that they are eliminating the worst abuses of factory farming. That is fantasy, that is myth, that is nonsense. And so what is happening is the welfareists won't engage that argument. They keep coming back and saying, if you criticize welfare reform, you don't care about the suffering of animals now. And the answer is that's nonsense. It's we don't think that the welfare reform that you're proposing is doing anything to help animals now, and we think there is an alternative which is not only more effective as a practical matter, but is consistent with the idea that we have no moral justification for using animals, however humanely we do it, and that is vegan education. But look, I think your listeners should go to My Face is on Fire, post the link, and let them read the exchange and judge for themselves as to which side is producing the substantive arguments and what side is producing a lot of smoke. No one is making value judgments about welfare reforms. I'm sure that they have, I'm sure that at least, many of them, perhaps most, perhaps all of them. I don't know. I mean, that's not the point. I'm sure that they sincerely believe in what they're doing. And I sincerely believe they're wrong. But I'm not expressing an opinion. I'm making arguments. And what is interesting is the woman who wrote the blog essay on My Face is on Fire, she was expressing arguments. She was making arguments. She was giving reasons. She wasn't expressing opinions. She wasn't saying, I like, this form of art better than that form of art. She was saying, I think this position that the welfareists are taking is wrong, and here are the reasons why it's wrong. And they don't deal with those arguments. They just come back and they say, you're vilifying, you're bashing, you're this, you're that. And I think it's really, really important that we understand that this isn't a debate about personalities or about moral integrity or about anything else. It's a question about,
effectiveness.
Yes, but it's a question of effectiveness in a context of we are killing in this country alone, 12, 13 billion animals a year. The number 10 billion, which I was using a few years ago, is actually wrong. It's actually more. And worldwide, we're killing, 53 billion a year, not including fish and other aquatic animals. I mean, that's an extraordinary number of animals. And the amount of suffering and death is just – it's hard to even wrap your head around. And so the question becomes, what do we do about it? And what I suggest is the perspective that I – present as the abolitionist approach is simply qualitatively different from the. I mean, it's not a question that sort of we all see the same thing, and so why are we arguing with each other? The answer is no, we don't all see the same thing. we see this in a very, very different way, and I think it's just very, very important to see that there are really very different things going on here, and that the welfareists I don't want to bore your listeners, so I'll try. And just if you start nodding off because you're getting bored, then just let's like yell or something. And I'll stop. But you see, I think that there's a fundamental philosophical difference which drives us in different directions. And let's look at the primary theorist of the reformist approach, the new welfarist, the protectionist, whatever you want to call it, approach. And that's Peter Singer. Now, Peter Singer's view is that we ought to do whatever we can to reduce suffering, and that that animals, the problem is the way we treat animals, not that we use animals, because Singer does not believe, like most of the utilitarians. I mean, Singer's in sort of a long line that started with Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill in England in the 19th century. And Peter Singer's sort of the latest, you know, he's just the latest version of these people. And all of the utilitarians took the position that we ought to be concerned about animal suffering, but that animal use itself didn't raise a question because animals are not self-aware in the same way humans are self-aware. So therefore, they don't have an interest in their lives in the same way that humans have an interest in their lives. So therefore, they don't care that we kill them. They care how we treat them and how we kill them. So Singer's view basically, and Singer said this, I mean, I quote this in stuff I've written. You can find this stuff and, you know, it's not that it's any secret, but Singer has been very, very open about saying, look, it may be okay to eat animals who have had a pleasant life and a relatively painless death because they live in an eternal present. They don't really care. You know, he sort of echoes Bentham's views that they don't really care that we're using them. They care how we use them. That is that's the basic philosophical issue that drives the welfarist position. I disagree with that completely. Look, I have no doubt that animal self-awareness is probably, you know, non-human self-awareness is probably different from human self-awareness simply because our self-awareness is linked with language, symbolic communication. And so, you know, the concepts that I have in my head, and I don't know whether they're the same concepts you have in your head because they have no access to your head. But, I mean, we don't know what goes on in each other's minds. We don't really know. I mean, we guess. I suspect that what goes on in the minds of animals is probably different because their interpretation of what goes, you know, of what they see, what they hear, what they experience is different because they don't have the linguistic concepts that we have. However, putting that aside, my response is, my comment to that is, who cares? They may not be self-aware in the same way that we're self-aware, but they are certainly self-aware. They're just self-aware in a different way. That's all. And so I disagree with the fundamental philosophical notion which drives, you know, I mean, I have no doubt that non-human animals have, and you know, whether insects do or not, I don't really know. But all of the animals that we routine, I don't kill insects, at least not intentionally. But certainly, all of the animals we routinely exploit on a day-to-day basis—the chickens, the pigs, the cows, the you know, the whatever, you know, the fish—they are all self-aware in the morally relevant way in that they have an interest in continuing to live. They prefer, they desire, they want to continue to live. So this basic, you know, so the basic philosophical issue which drives the welfarist theory is something I disagree with. Now, the other part of the welfarist theory is that you should always reduce suffering whenever you can. Now, that sounds good, but let me give you an example where you see the sort of the – let's assume that we have someone who's being tortured, and we've got this person strapped into a chair, and we are delivering electric shocks, very, very painful electric shocks to this person. Now, is it better for this person to be seated or tied into a comfortable padded chair, or is it better for this person to be tied into a very hard chair while this person is being tortured? Now, I find that to be a somewhat dumb question, but nevertheless, it sort of teases that the answer is, well, I guess if you asked me that question in that context, I would think you were a very strange person. But I would say to you, well, I guess, Elizabeth, it's better that the person is in a comfortable chair, you know, rather than a hard chair. But I have a basic problem with what we're doing here in the first place, and it sort of trivial to ask whether or not the person should be in a soft chair or a hard chair. I feel the same way about these welfare reforms. When someone says to me, do you think battery cages, don't you think that cage-free is better than battery cages? And the answer is, well, it's hard for me to know because I've seen both and I think they're both horrible. I mean, they're both hideous. I mean, the idea, the whole cage-free, it's interesting use of language because it entails or implies this notion of freedom. They're cage-free. They're not. They're in one large cage. They're in a huge barn. They're all crawling over each other. They're all urinating on each other. They're all defecating on each other. They're still being debeaked because they're in these in hideously intensive conditions, and they'll fight. There's forced molting going on, and they all end up in the slaughterhouse. I mean, it's like. Does it involve less torture than the battery cage? And the answer is, let's assume it does. To the extent that it does, it's like talking about whether or not you're better off with a padded chair when you're being tortured, or whether you're better off on a hard chair. And so this is the basic. These are the basic disagreements. This is not these are legitimate disagreements. And what I find frustrating, and what I think is so wonderful as an example of what I'm talking about, is My Faces on Fire blog and the subsequent comments. Because what happens, what you see, is a complete unwillingness on the part of the welfareists to engage the discussion and to simply rely on catchphrases on almost like a cult-like way. It's like, well, you don't care about animals. You're vilifying. You're bashing. You're how can you attack so-and-so? How can you? It's a bunch of stock phrases which have no substance and which do not engage the fundamental, theoretical, and practical strategic questions which are being raised. These things are very, very important, and we shouldn't put them aside. Something else that happens that you see in this 100 email exchange, which is quite interesting, is you see people saying, yeah, but people aren't going to become vegan overnight. And the answer is, I would like to know, who has ever said that they are? Because I get this all the time. They say, well, Professor Francione, people aren't going to become vegan overnight. And the answer is, whoever said that they were. I certainly never have said that. As far as I know, you've never said that. And as far as I know, nobody has ever said that who advocates the abolitionist approach. And I people say to me frequently, well, Professor Francione, you live in an ivory tower. You think everyone's going to become vegan tomorrow. And the answer is, no, I don't think everyone's going to become vegan tomorrow. And two, I don't live in an ivory tower. Yes, I make my living as a professor. That is true. But I have been actively involved for much of my adult life as a legal advocate for animals and animal advocates. I have been in the trenches, as it were, and it's a result of being in the trenches and seeing how ineffective animal welfare regulation is that led – look, Elizabeth, I started off as a welfarist. I mean, I started off, as we all did, in many ways. In certain ways, if you go back to the early 1980s when people weren't really talking about rights versus welfare. I mean, it was actually the distinction was there was some of us who were vegans way back then and who thought that nobody should be consuming animals, and then there were people who were consuming animals and thought that they should be treated better. But we didn't really sort of distinguish. That only happened sort of later in the 1980s as people started thinking more about these things and focusing on the questions and where strategy needed to be mapped out in terms of where we were going to go in the future. And then disagreements started emerging about, well, should we go for regulation or should we go for something else? Should we try other methods and other approaches? And so, but it certainly, I mean, had you asked me in the early 1980s, well, do you support welfare reform? I would have said, yes, sure, I do. As part of this overall, this is how we're going to march into the future. It's going to be, and I didn't realize until sort of later on in the 1980s, probably 84. Well, I don't know, mid-80s, when it became absolutely clear to me, and then it just became more and more clear to me that welfare regulation was never going to lead us anywhere except to more exploitation. That is, I was what I call a new welfarist. I believe that welfare regulation would lead in the right direction. It may not be what I liked in the short term, but it would lead in the right direction. But then it became clear to me, A, that was philosophically unsound, because if animal use is wrong, then we ought to say it's wrong and not support regulation as a moral matter. But it was strategically and practically unsound in that it didn't work. And so, you know, I think that this idea that, you know, that I or you or anybody else is saying, well, you know, we expect veganism overnight. The answer is that's nonsense. Look, a lot of people are going to continue to eat animal products. Whatever we do, a lot of people are going to do that. So the question becomes, how do we best respond to that? And my answer to that is, we need, if we're ever going to change things, we need to shift the paradigm away from the idea that animals are things that we can use as long as we use them in a particular way. And that we got to get away from that. And we have to realize that morally, that's a problematic position to take, but we also have to realize that strategically it's a problematic position to take, because animals are economic commodities. And because they're economic commodities, and because of basic laws of economics, particularly in a world in which we have what is called free trade, which is basically, you know, you know what free trade is. I mean, it's, yeah. And in a world in which we have free trade, because animals are chattel property and have only economic value, to the extent that we were to have regulations that actually did have an impact and provided significant welfare benefits to animals, it would raise the price of those animal products considerably, and that would then have economic effects. For example, if country X has higher welfare standards and the price of animal products in country X are higher, let's assume hypothetically that happens. What will then happen is the animal products will be imported from other countries that have the lower welfare standards, because you can't stop those imports under these free trade agreements. You can't interfere with the imports of those products. And number one, number two, to the extent that you were even to get other nations to sort of raise their welfare standards in ways that significantly affected price, consumers would go crazy, and they would be very, very unhappy, because and demand would fall, and that would make producers unhappy. And because people may be willing to pay a couple cents more for a cage-free egg, and by the way, or an organic egg, and by the way, they're doing that not just for concerns about animal welfare, which aren't being satisfied by these alternatives. It's health. It's people are concerned. They say, oh, you know, guys, you know, all these hormones, all these antibiotics. It's very, very much health. Don't kid yourself. Mm-hmm. But people may be willing to pay a couple cents more for an organic egg or for a cage-free egg or something, because they think it's healthier, or for organic meat because they think it's healthier. But the vast majority of people are not going to pay higher prices for animals that have been raised in situations in which there are significant welfare reforms involved. I haven't seen any of those yet, by the way. But I mean, assuming hypothetically that such a thing occurred, people would respond to it badly. Why would they respond to it badly, Elizabeth? Because their heads and hearts aren't prepared for it yet, because the paradigm hasn't shifted. People don't yet really assign inherent value to animals. And so as a result, that's not going to work as a practical matter. And so this is what I think we've really got to confront. And what is so wonderful about the My Face is on Fire blog and the responses is this: the writer of the essay responsibly, coherently, intelligently lays these issues out. I mean, not all of these issues. I mean, she's basically saying, look, this is just not the right way to go. And she makes some arguments. She presents them in a very, very, I think, responsible, professional way. And she ends up getting this sort of, you know, dumped on, like, you know, how dare you, you know, how dare you, you know, and you don't care about animals and you just, you know, I would rather help animals than bash other advocates, or, you know, crap like that. And it just drives you nuts. So I think it's very, very important to sort of recognize really what's going on here, and recognizing that this is not just all big one movement. You know, I find it very disheartening or disconcerting when one of the people who responded to that essay, well, more than one, but people suggested that this was just squabbling, that animal people were squabbling. And the answer is no. That's not what this is about. You know, squabbling is when, you know, you and I are going to go to a movie and, you know, you want to see one movie and I want to see another movie. And there's really nothing. It's not that, you know,
it's
I have
life
a philosoph-
and death.
I don't have a philosophical problem with your movie and you don't have a philosophical problem with my movie. It's just, you know, you like one, you know, actor more than I like another actor. Or you like one type of film more than I like it. That's squabbling, Elizabeth. When you are talking about fundamental moral issues about whether or not, you know, Should I be advocating against rape, or should I be advocating for humane rape? You know, if you're going to rape somebody, please don't beat that person. You know, let's have humane rape. Let's have a campaign. That's not a matter of squabbling. Those are fundamentally, philosophically, and strategically, pragmatically, very different positions to take. You could say the same thing about rape, Elizabeth, because, you know, the animal people are always saying that animals are going to continue to be exploited. Well, I got news for you. Women are going to continue to be raped. It's probably one of the most
common crimes
that goes on in the world is rape. It's been going on forever. It'll go on forever as long as there's patriarchy and as long as there's the inequality that we have in our society, which basically, as a matter of social construction, makes that possible.
Yeah, we're trying to change all that too. It's all about
exactly. And so you know, you could say the same thing about rape. There's rape going on right now. Very violent rapes going on all over the world. So Elizabeth, let's form an organization. You know, the Humane Rape Society of the United States and New Zealand. Well, it'll be an international endeavor. And let's sort of, you know, let's start working with the rapists and let's say, you know, blah 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 blah. And you know, obviously that's absurd. Nobody would think that, you know, I mean nobody would or should think of that as a serious option. But I suggest that it's only our speciesism.
Yes.
That gets in the way of our seeing that that's exactly what we're doing.
Exactly.
When we're talking about the animal situation, it just makes no sense.
No.
Now
and
I'm gonna take a breath.
Okay. Well, I want to respond. Good timing. One of the things I noticed was a lot of people said, and I've heard this a lot too, is look, I'm an abolitionist, but you know, I support what these guys are doing. And they start to say, you're elitist and things. And I think that you hit the nail on the head with what you just said about it's the speciesism, because people, even people who claim to really genuinely want to end this suffering and genuinely care about animals, they must be speciesist to say something like that, because they would never say that with regards to rape. Right, just like you said.
Right.
So I just cannot, to my core, even begin to even go anywhere near promoting anything but abolition and ending it. And this is wrong, and that's it. I cannot, as a core belief, because I feel the same way about it as I do about rape, as I do about child molestation. So I don't think you can say that you are an abolitionist. I saw a lot of people say, I'm an abolitionist. You know, I want to be an abolitionist. That's what I was talking about. There's a lot of that. And I hate, you know, labels and words and playing with words and all that. But the bottom line is, you hit it right on the head. Really, fundamentally speaking, I hate to say this, but I get the impression that those people unwittingly are also speciesist.
Well, no, I think you're accurate, and I don't think that I think that that's an accurate analysis. As a matter of fact, I am sending off to the publisher today a book called The Animal Rights Debate, Abolition or Regulation, which I co-wrote with Professor Robert Garner of the University of Leicester in the United Kingdom. And I argue in favor of abolition, and Robert argues in favor of he takes a position I call new welfarist. He characterizes it as protectionist. But he takes a position that, you know, he'd like to see a lot of things abolished, but he thinks that welfare reform is the way to get there. I explain why I think that doesn't work. But what comes out in the book is that Robert and I have a fundamental, and he actually acknowledges this, that we have a fundamental moral disagreement in that He believes that human life has greater moral value than non-human life. And it has to do with the differences in our cognition, that, you know, we're smarter than they are. We're, you know, we have a greater sense of ourselves. We have a stronger sense of personhood. And I keep coming back to him, and you'll see in the book, I come back and I say, we may have a different concept of personhood, but it doesn't mean that our concept of personhood is superior. And I have a problem with this because I agree. I think it is speciesist. I think what we're doing is, and why is it speciesist? It's speciesist because we are privileging our form of cognition. We're saying we have a certain way of looking at the world. And you know what's really interesting is that even people who are rights advocates, which is why I call my approach the abolitionist approach to animal rights, to distinguish it from other approaches. For example, Tom Reagan, who is a rights advocate, and he is, I mean, he clearly is a rights advocate, but Tom takes this position, which is very troubling to me. He believes that humans have greater opportunities for satisfaction than non-humans. And so that if we're on the boat, you know, we're on the mythical lifeboat and we have to throw over the dog or the human, he believes we're morally obligated to throw over the dog because, you know, if it's a normal dog and a normal human, the human's got greater opportunities for satisfaction. Now, one of the things I like about non-human animals is they don't think in those terms. But what I would say to that situation is I live with four rescued dogs, we've had up to seven. Three died, and now we have four, and we're sort of at four right now. We'll probably go up in the future, but I watch those. I live with those dogs. I observe their behavior every day. I'm fascinated by their behavior, and you know what? I think it's simply wrong, and I say this in the book. I have a border collie. Her name is Katie Jane. She is a remarkable dog, and they're all remarkable. But they're all different personality. All have different personalities because they are persons. They're non-human persons, and the idea. I mean, Katie seems to get such joy out of everything that she does in her life. However trivial it may seem to me, she seems to have grand time doing everything. Now, if you tell me that I've got greater opportunities for satisfaction than Katie does, I suggest that empirically may be wrong. I certainly don't see how that's clear. I mean, who is to say that she doesn't have greater, you know, joy in her life and more opportunities for satisfaction than I have in my life? Because most human beings that I know, you know, have anxieties and we're, you know, the depressions and all sorts of things. I mean, you know, we may have opportunities, we don't take them.
Think animals are enlightened, and I try to learn by watching them enjoy life because I think that we have lost a lot of enlightenment.
I agree with that. I agree with that. I agree with that very, very strongly. And so I think that, you know, we need to really sort of, we need to focus on, you are right. You're correct to say that the welfarist position is speciesist. It is. And that's not, again, that's not attacking them. You're not calling them a name. I'm not calling them a name. I'm saying that their notion that it's all right to use animals as long as we do so humanely or without, you know, in a particular sort of way, as long as we treat them all right, it's all right for us to use them because they're different from us. They don't have minds that are similar to us. I suggest that speciesist because, first of all, I think empirically that may, you know, well, there are differences, but I don't see how those differences translate into moral license to use without a speciesist premise that's embedded in there. So I think you're absolutely right. And I wanted to say something else about, well, I want to, let's go back to this notion about vegan education. The question is, you know, some people, many people are going to continue to eat animals. So what are we going to do about it? Are we going to tinker at the edges of death and sort of say, okay, fine, people are going to continue to torture people, so let's have campaigns for you know, soft chairs. Women are going to continue women and children are going to continue to be abused and battered, so why don't we go for a humane battery? Or are we going to say, look, this is fundamentally wrong, and we ought to stop it. We ought to stop it because it's wrong. The idea that it can be done humanely is wrong. There's, you know, it's that we need to confront this and shift the paradigm and think about why is it that we think, all of us agree with the notion that it's wrong to inflict unnecessary suffering on animals. Everybody agrees with that. Why don't we see? Why can't we see that if necessity, if we really believe that, and most of us do, why can't we see that if it means anything, it means we can impose pain, suffering, and death for reasons of pleasure, amusement, or convenience, and whatever other gray areas that may raise that we need to talk about further, the bottom line is it requires that we stop eating and wearing them and using them for entertainment purposes and sport purposes and all sorts of right away. Those are no-brainers. You don't need a complicated philosophical theory to come to that conclusion. As a matter of fact, as I said before, the only thing that's complicated, and again, I'm totally opposed to the use of all animals in experiments, but the only use of animals that is not transparently trivial is the use of animals in biomedical experiments to cure serious human illnesses. I don't think it can be morally justified, but I think that requires a little bit more complicated discussion. Everything else is a you know, no-brainer. I mean, it's a no-brainer. And so that's what I think we ought to be educating people about. And my the response I get is overwhelming. I mean, just yesterday, I posted a blog yesterday called The Revolution of the Heart. And I got so far about 15 emails from people saying, I just wanted to let you know that as a result of reading your blogs and, you know, or reading one of your books or watching one of the videos on your thing, I become a vegan. And I'm telling you, vegan education can be very effective if people are made to understand these issues in a clear way. The problem is they're getting confused because on one hand, you know, they have these large animal groups saying to them, well, you know, in an ideal world, we wouldn't eat meat, but it's okay for us to be conscientious omnivores, you know, today. And so go and buy cage-free eggs and go and buy, these labeling schemes are horrible that, you know, that all of the organizations are supporting, humane this and humane that, you know. And it's giving people the wrong idea, and it's sending a mixed, crazy, confused message. If the message is clear, people will respond to it. Will everybody respond to it? Absolutely not. Will a lot of people respond to it? Absolutely. And so the bottom line is, why, given that there are people out there that we can reach, why aren't we reaching them? Why aren't we putting our resources and speaking with one voice into reaching them? Because the more of those people that we get, the more of those people that we can convince, the more we will shift the paradigm and the more that we will shift the thinking in the society. And I want to make one final point, and that is this. One idea that comes out a lot in the comments, and I've been dealing with this for years and years now with welfare reform people, is they say, why are you arguing with us? Go argue with the really evil people, the exploiters. And I always get a kick out of that because my response to that is always, by the way, I'll be happy to. Tell me, who are the exploiters? Because you know, we like to demonize, you know, the factory farmers and the vivisectors and the furriers and whatnot. But you know what? And I don't, you know, obviously I don't agree with what they're doing. But why are they doing it? They're not doing it. I mean, yeah, there may be. Some of these people might do it because they're really sadistic people, and they derive in a literal way some sort of erotic satisfaction out of torturing things, and it's illegal to do it with animals, so they torture them. There may be some of those people. I think that if there are such people, they are in a very, very small minority. That the farmers, the vivisectors, the furriers, the everybody else's, they are people who are like you and me, trying to make a living, and you know they may be doing it on a grander scale or whatever, but they're trying to make a living and they're responding to demand. People eat animals, so there will be, as long as people are demanding the product, there will be people investing their capital in providing that product, and so I think that we have to understand something, that we are the problem, not they. They are responding to our demand. And you know, it's really interesting. I just love when particularly these more traditional welfare reform, well, all of them, I mean, more traditional, less traditional. I mean, PETA claims that, you know, only half of its membership is vegetarian. And I guess that means that not even that half is all vegan, but the other half isn't vegetarian. Who are the exploiters? Well, you know, if you take the abolitionist approach, then you know, you start looking to the fact that, you know, yeah, you got people who are your donors, who are contributing to you. They're exploiting animals because they're not vegans. They're continuing to go and buy these products. They're continuing to generate the demand for these products. They're exploiters. They're the ones who are generating the demand that is being met by the institutional exploiters. So I think we've really got to sort of focus on the fact that, you know, demonizing the farmers and sort of like, you know, let's go after the real enemies, the farmers. Let's go after the real enemies, the vivisectors. That's soy-based baloney. You know, it's just crazy to say that. And I believe very strongly in the principle of ahimsa or nonviolence. I'm very, very committed to that. And so I don't believe in any sort of violence. But one of the many reasons, apart from my commitment to ahimsa, it's one of the reasons why I get very, very upset with animal advocates who advocate violence against institutional animal exploiters, because what sense does that make? I mean, many of these people are themselves not vegan. Many of these people have families that aren't vegan, and many of these people have donors that are not vegan, and many of these people, those people are exploiting. They themselves, who are, if they're not vegan, are exploiters. Their family members, their friends, their donors, their close, you know, whatever, their lovers, they're exploiting. So why is it that we demonize the institutional exploiter? And the answer is because it's convenient, and it helps to sort of stir up passion and irrational thinking, which is what all of this stuff is. And so I really think that it's important that we try to think clearly about these things, and we really see that this is a complicated situation, and we've got to do better at thinking our way out of it. And we're not doing a very good job of thinking our way out of it. And indeed, that blog, the responses to that blog really sort of indicate the sorts of levels of confusion that we're talking about here. And I think that we really do need to, to rethink these issues.
I totally agree. I wanted to get back to one of the things that you said about, I know that Singer's philosophy is utilitarian and it's okay to use them. I also want to address, in my very short experience, people who would disagree with that themselves. And these are the people that I'm saying are unwitting speciesists, in my opinion, that I've come up with, because they wouldn't agree with what you said about that. They'd say, that's not me. I don't think it's okay that we use them. I think it's terrible that we use them. But they've, number one, they've given up on something that hasn't even been tried, which is, keep it real and let's talk about veganism. They've completely underestimated. So not only are they being speciesist against the animals to think that it's even excusable, if you do believe that to your core and you are so dedicated that you feel that, you know that it's wrong, you're a vegan, and yet you will still compromise on your message, I believe that you are being speciesist and you're not fulfilling what you believe anyway. So that's completely mistaken. Number two, you are being elitist. And we get a lot of comments about this elitistness. Excuse me, who's being elitist? You're giving up. You're saying nobody's going to go vegan. So, you know, the animals are just going to have to keep getting eaten. And at least they can stretch their legs out. You're being elitist to the entire human race because you're completely underestimating them because this hasn't even been tried. And you're being speciesist to the animals because it's absolutely unacceptable. It is unacceptable, if you believe as strongly as I do that it's wrong what we're doing, to compromise on the message at all in this elitist way to the risk. And that is what bothers me. I think there's a lot of a lot of people who are supporting these reforms who, like a lot of the ones I read, they're like, they wouldn't agree with what Singer says themselves. No, I don't think animals should be used. I think animals do have an interest in continuing life. I think that they are cognitively aware. I think that their lives do matter to them as much as our lives matter to us. But nobody's going to go vegan overnight. But this is what's working. Well, that to me is the worst kind of speciesist. I mean, I would rather deal with the utilitarian because I wouldn't even bother with them. But these are the people who I think are really confused and are confusing the general public. because they're saying, I'm an animal lover. I love animals. Well, that's the ones that bother me. And I think there's a lot of them around, Gary, who wouldn't even be able to relate to what you're saying about Singer.
Well, I agree with you. I think that there are, you know, look, I think that there are a lot of people who are confused about this, but that's because we live in an age of confusion. Even though we have all of this technological stuff and we have all these great ways of communicating each other and we have Twitter, Tweeter, whatever it's called, Facebook and all that stuff, the bottom line is most of us have not really honed our thinking skills or our critical skills very, very much because we're all overwhelmed in many ways. We're all overwhelmed with the data that's coming in. We're all overwhelmed by all sorts of things. And I agree with you that there's a lot of confusion out there. And I also agree with your analysis about elitism because I think that there's nothing that is more elite than thinking that we are superior, we're morally superior to animals, so therefore it's all right for us to use them. I think that that the whole fundamental philosophical premise the welfarist perspective, the welfarist approach, is itself elitist. I agree with you. It is elitist to say that human beings are incapable of understanding this message. They're all just a bunch of, you know, dumbos that are going to continue to eat animals no matter what we say. The answer is, well, that's elitist. And as far as, you know, I look, you know, one of the problems with the movement or whatever you want to call it, this phenomenon, is that people don't read anything. And so, you know, they don't read anything. So it's like, you know, yeah, they don't. You're right. You know, I wouldn't agree with Singer. That's because they all own animal liberation. But, you know, very few of them have ever read it. You know, I mean, animal people buy books. They have great collections of books, but very few of them read them. And that's a problem. I mean, people really do need. One of the reasons why I started the website www.abolitionistapproach.com is to try to sort of get the ideas out there in these bite-sized ways so that people can, you know, people can sort of get the ideas in, you know, in a couple of minutes of reading, because it's clear to me. I mean, you know, if I had 5 cents for everybody who's, you know, who says, well, you know, does Singer's a rights person, isn't he? And you say, no, actually, he actually rejects the concept of rights because he's a utilitarian, and utilitarians reject the notion of moral rights for philosophical reasons. And they say, gee, you know, I didn't know that. And I say, well, did you have it? You have animal liberation? Well, yeah. Did you ever read it? No. And so that's the problem. And so, you know, what we've ended up in a very sort of strange way. You know, things change, but they stay the same. You know, in the medieval times, the Catholic Church used to sell indulgences. You know, people used to do really horrible things, but they'd go to the church and they could buy their way out of hell by making a contribution to the church. And now we have something called, you know, the animal welfare establishment, which sells indulgences. And, you know, it says, you know, look, you know, if you want to be a conscientious animal lover, that's fine. You know, give us a donation and, you know, and we'll, you know, give you absolution. And so, you know, we're, you know, as I mentioned in my blog essay yesterday, you know, we're selling shares of, you know, shares of cage-free compassion, basically. And that's a fundamentally messed up situation. And I think but you know, again, things change, you know, from medieval times to now, but they remain the same. Now we're selling indulgences of a different kind. And you know, we're now facing this enormous moral challenge of animal exploitation. 53 billion, not counting fish and other aquatic animals, being, you know, horribly tortured and slaughtered every year simply because they taste good. But the response to that is, you know, not to express moral, you know, moral objection, and not to try to convince other humans that this is simply not the right thing to do, and that we, you know, it as a moral matter and as a practical matter, it simply doesn't work. And you know, there are all sorts of other issues that I think are secondary, but nevertheless, they're there: environmental issues and health issues and whatnot. But you know, is the response that, or is the response, let's sell indulgences in cage-free compassion? Give us your money and you can continue doing what you want to do, and you know, and you can feel good about it morally. And that's exactly what's going on here. But in any event, listen, I've got a little bit of work to finish up to get my book off, you know, because you know, you have to get it in, you know, I have to put it on discs.
Oh, congratulations.
And make
copies. Oh, well, we'll talk about it when it comes back out.
Thank you. Columbia University Press is publishing it. It'll probably be out, I hope, this fall. It may be late. Well, it depends on how long the process takes. Sometimes they go through faster, sometimes they go through slower. But it's going to be a very interesting book. In the first part of the book, I argue the abolitionist approach. In the second part of the book, Professor Garner argues the regulationist approach, and he argues that he argues precisely because he thinks, and I don't want to characterize him, but I think this is fair. In any event, you'll be able to read the book, and yes, you'll judge whether it's fair. Robert's position is that animals have a right not to suffer. He doesn't dismiss rights. He says that animals have a right not to suffer, but they don't have a right not to be used because they are different from us and they don't have the same sort of cognitive mental sophistication that we have. And then in the third part of the book, he and I go back and forth and discuss these ideas. And he obviously thinks that animal welfare reform has provided great benefits. I don't. We discuss those issues. We discuss the American situation, the European situation, because some people think, well, things are wonderful in Europe. And the answer is that's not true either, at least not from my perspective, maybe from Robert's. And so we go back and forth. I think it's an exciting book. I think people will like it. I think, you know, and look, the bottom line here is, I want to make 2 points. And one is, you've got on one side the abolitionist approach and on one side the welfarist approach. We're not all in the same pot, and it's just a matter of squabbling. These are fundamentally different ways of looking at the world. And I don't know whether, you know, I will persuade some people on the welfarist side to come over to the abolitionist side. Robert may persuade some people on the abolitionist side to come over to the welfarist side. But we're not. The people, you know, I'm pretty confident of my views, and some of the welfarists are pretty confident of theirs. So it's unlikely that, you know, that some of these folks are going to pick up the book and you know, and say, gee, you know, Gary's been right all along, and you know, I'm going to become an abolitionist. It's unlikely that some of the leaders of these organizations are going to say, gee, I'm going to change. You know, I'm not going to call it the Humane Society of the United States. I'm going to call it the Abolitionist Society of the United States. That is unlikely. But there's a zillion people who are as yet undecided, who care about the issue and who don't know what to think about it. And those are the people that Robert and I are writing for. We're making the pitch to them. The final point I want to raise with you is, I want to go back to this idea. It is a revolution of the heart, and we must understand it as such. What we must understand is, most of us subscribe to some spiritual tradition or other that condemns violence, whether you're a Christian, whether you're a Jew, a Muslim, or as I am, a Jain, whatever, it doesn't really matter what you are. You subscribe to some notion that nonviolence is an important spiritual principle. What we need to understand is what we are doing with non-human animals. You know, there may be issues of violence in the world which are complicated and where reasonable minds can differ. But when it comes to the slaughter of 53 billion animals, where the best justification we have is they taste good, that fundamentally challenges us, each of us who subscribes to some spiritual tradition that rejects violence, which basically means all of us. And I think it's really very important. It's very, very, very important that we take a step back and look at whether or not the violence that we are inflicting on non-human animals is consistent with what we say we believe, or whether we're just being hypocrites. And if it's not consistent with what we believe, to confront our hypocrisy, to confront our moral schizophrenia, and to stop. And you know what? I haven't had an animal product, you know, I have not knowingly had an animal product in a long time, years, decades. And my arms and legs haven't fallen off. I'm not blind. I'm not deaf. And I'm in pretty good shape, at least as far as I know. And it is not necessary for people to have animal products. And it ends up being something we do simply because it tastes good. And that's like saying rape is justified because it feels good to the rapist. The rapist enjoys it. And that can't be right. And I'm not meaning to insult anybody by saying that animal exploitation is the same as rape. I'm not. I don't want to compare evils, because people always say to me, "Well, do you think that rape is, you know, child molestation and animal exploitation. Which do you think is worse? And that's, to me, as dumb as asking the question, do you think that it was worse that Hitler killed Romanis in addition to killing Jews? Was it worse to kill Jews than to kill Romanis? The answer is everything he did was horrible. It doesn't, you know, I mean, it's not a question. Was it worse to do this? Ranking evils is a problematic thing to do. But what I'm saying is that we really do need to take a step back and say, can we really justify this violence? You know, can we really justify this violence? And I think the answer that we will come up with is no, we cannot. And then the question becomes, what do we do? And the answer is simple. You go vegan. It's easy to do. It's simple to do. It's better for your health. It's better for the planet. And most importantly, it's the right thing to do. And that we all know that. It's just a question of teasing it out. That's our challenge. And I'm going to continue to step up to that challenge every single day that I am breathing. And you know, I never let a day go by without discussing this with somebody, whether it's somebody in a shopping, you know, line, or whether it's somebody I meet in a video store, or whether it's a student I have, or whether it's, you know, whether it's a show like this or whatever. It doesn't matter. And I'm going to do another one of these this afternoon, which means I really got to get off the phone. And it's probably, what is it, 3 o'clock in the morning with you now, 2:30 in the morning. You have a lot of energy because you're a vegan. Anyway, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
I send my finest regards to all of your listeners out there in New Zealand. I hope one day I will visit that beautiful country.
Yes.
And thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, Gary. It's been a pleasure as always. Can't wait to read the book. Okay, I hope you enjoyed the interview as much as I did. And I would just like to mention that the blog which we were discussing, to have a look at this commentary, which I really do recommend, is the blog site is called My Face is on Fire. And it is a Blogspot blog. So it's my-face-is-on-fire.blogspot.com. So My Face is on Fire, just with dashes between them. My Face is on Fire. And the article we're talking about is called HSUS Paul Shapiro Reaches Out to Meat Industry. And you can go on there and have a read. There's a lot of comments to read, and I certainly read every single one and learned a lot. And I do think that it's a really valuable discussion. You know, I've always said I don't want to argue with other vegans about these kinds of things, but if challenged, of course, and you know, I don't back down from my views, and if challenged, of course, I back up the view of abolition for all the reasons that I keep saying over and over again. And I really just wish that we could all be united and, you know, just talk about veganism. If you want to keep getting donations and dressing up in animal costumes, okay, if you want to show videos of factory farming, but please, please, let's keep the message real and the truth. Let's educate people about the abolition of the use of all animals for all purposes, for all products. Let's educate people about veganism united. And, you know, we can argue with each other about personal differences later, but I wish that we could all talk about veganism to people. I really believe from the bottom of my being it's the right thing to do. And I believe that if you believe that animals should not be used and that we should be vegan, and if you are vegan, you should say that to everybody else and not be scared to do it. Nothing's going to change unless we tell the truth. That is my sincere belief. All right, thanks for listening. Check out the blog, My Face is on Fire. It's actually a fantastic blog. There's everything on there. But if you want to have a look at this latest entry, there's a lot of commentary on there. But I do recommend just reading in general. It's a really wonderfully well-written and objective viewpoint of somebody who is, you know, we're all trying to we're all trying to abolish the use of animals. Let's do it effectively. All right, thanks for listening. I'll be back next week. And if you have any comments or you want to email me, my email is nzveganpodcast@me.com. And my blogspot address, and I'm going to put a link to this. There's a link to this blog already, but I'm going to put a link to that specific discussion in this episode's description. And my blog is nzveganpodcast.blogspot.com. And I would like to thank once again, thank you, Professor Frenzio, for coming on. And I cannot wait to have you on the show again. And I hope that it's soon rather than later. And I'm very much looking forward to the book coming out. All right, I'll be back. Bye.